just treatment. The Portland police killing of James Chassy on February 24th, 7 p.m. at the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Community Room in Aloha. The film Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassy, will be shown, and followed by a question and answer session with Jim Chassy, father of James Chassy Jr. Again, that's Unjust Treatment, The Portland Police Killing of James Chassy, on February 24th, 7 p.m. at the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Community Room, 20665 Southwest Blanton Street in Aloha. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House. And by Clackamas Community College Theater, presenting The Laramie Project, a stage production based on extensive interviews of citizens of Laramie, Wyoming, in the aftermath of the murder of Matthew Shepard in 1998. The Laramie Project runs from February 26th through March 8th at the Osterman Theater, and ticket information is available at clackamas.edu/theater or by calling 503-594-3153.
I'm Demay Roberts, Stage and Studio. You're listening to music by Parfait Basselet. He has a concert this weekend to debut his new EP, but it's sold out. So I just want you to know about his music, learn more about him, and hear his music at parfaitonline.com. Today we feature two writers. First up, Damaris Webb, who's performing her autobiographical play, The Box Marked Black, about growing up mixed race in America. And then in the latter part of the show, we feature Matt Colbert, a writer in Newburgh, who's just published his debut novel, The Futility of Nicknames, which is inspired by some elements of his life, but is an entirely fictional story. Stay tuned. This is Stage and Studio.
L'envie d'être une star comme au ciné. Préfère écrire pour les âmes enchaînées. Donc nouvelle donnée, écrit sans peur de gêner. L'écrit notre quotidien comme on l'a connu et mené.
I'm Demay Roberts. Before we get started, I wanted to do a shout-out for the Red Door Project's August Wilson Monologue Competition. The regional finals are showcased on March 2nd at 7 p.m. at Portland Center Stage's Girding Theater. That's in downtown Portland. High school students from throughout Portland are competing, and the whole show is emceed. Get this, it's emceed by Russell Hornsby, one of the stars of the hit show Grimm. So it sounds like a really great evening. For more info, visit reddoorproject.org. With me in the studio right now, I want to introduce actress, writer, director, and teacher Damaris Webb. Welcome to Stage and Studio.
Thanks, Dime.
Hey, it's great to have you here. This is the first time you've been here.
Yes.
I've talked about you in the past, I think. I think we featured a play that you were directing.
Yes.
But you weren't here. So it's good to have you. I mean, you're quite the busy actress, it seems like, especially lately. And you're bringing back your solo show, The Box Marked Black, and it's for one night only on March 6th. And this is a very personal show that you've written, very personal.
Yes.
And that you're performing. Now, tell us the full title of your play.
The full title of the play is The Box Marked Black, Tales of a African-American Growing Up Mulatto with Sock Puppets.
See, that was a mouthful for me, so I wanted you to say that. What an intriguing title. So I assume all of that happens. You have sock puppets.
Yes, there are definitely sock puppets.
And you talk about your mixed race, biracial, multiracial experiences.
Yeah, this story started for me as an investigation of my grandmother's hands, and it became a 10-minute piece talking about different family members. And when I say family, I also mean those who influenced me, those who became the support of my journey in life. And after my mom passed away a few years ago, I returned to the story and began asking the questions of my other relatives and family members before they too would pass away. So it's been a wonderful journey to be able to have a container or context, a frame with which to filter these stories. And as I'm a performing artist, that's the only way I know how. And then the other aspect of that was finding the different templates to use, the different forms to use to express the story making. And that's how the sock puppets came out. It wasn't originally my intention that I would have sock puppets, but in order to become the iconic TV characters that are part of the show, in my experiments with me being physically them, that wasn't working. And so I tried different forms with my dramaturg and sock puppets. Laura Ingalls Wilder is an amazing sock puppet.
Oh, all of a sudden it just came to you. So it's autobiographical, but it sounds to me like it's oral history too.
Yes, it is definitely a storytelling aspect.
So do you it sounds like you also keep adding to it.
There are some parts that shift and emerge, but right now it is a set piece. It will be interesting to see where it goes in the future, though, and I'm very excited that I've been having opportunities to bring it back.
It seems like you've done like a full run of it at one point when you first debuted it, and then you've been bringing it back, and it's been evolving.
Yes.
So what time period does it cover? Do you go all the way back to when you were born or before with your grandparents?
Yes, it goes back to my parents and my grandparents, and then charts me through the pre-Huxtable era.
Now, tell us about the pre-Huxtable era. That, of course, references Bill Cosby's show. That was like, I think, mid-80s through the early 90s. Mm-hmm. So that's when you grew up.
Mm-hmm. That was my coming of age.
Coming of age. So what do you mean by pre-Huxtable? What was it like before them?
Right. So right now we have our first black president. But those of us of mixed race think that he is our first mixed race president.
You know, being biracial myself, I have called him our first mixed race president. You know, he is also our first African-American president.
Right.
And you can be both.
Exactly.
Yes.
And growing up, there was, though, in pop culture, in television, in movies, there was no one who looked like me or had my general kind of story to refer to. There were very few black roles in general. And then as a mixed race woman, there was nobody, especially even in commercials, which has just recently been happening.
It's just been happening, and more and more, I must say, because I find that a positive change.
Absolutely.
But the box marked black refers to having to do, I mean, I always say check other, you know, that there wasn't an option for what I was.
Right.
But so what does box marked black refer to?
So when I hold the talkbacks after the performances, which to me is one of the parts that continues to evolve and grow, and to me is the culminating aspect of my sharing with an audience, that's the question that I generally first ask: what box do you mark for yourself? And you know, we know that there are a great support of having these kind of awkward boxes to mark, and it is just human nature to give ourselves certain definitions or make certain judgments about others or ourselves to move forward, to make these kinds of decisions. But it's also very interesting, like you pointed to, what does other mean? Is it outside of something else? What is black? What is, because as white people, I am quite sure that the Greeks do not feel the same as the French about a lot of things.
There's a bit of a difference there, isn't there? Well, as a biracial person myself, I've gone through a series of names, and I've done radio pieces about that and wrote about it, you know, going from all the different names for identity through the decades, because it's changed so much and it's so fluid. What are some of the names that you use to define yourself, to define your identity?
Artist, dog mom, mulatto.
You actually use the word?
Yeah.
What kind of reaction do you get from that?
And that's interesting, too.
Yeah.
And also the time that I grew up, that was the word. That was the word, mm-hmm. right?
I think I grew up with Eurasian, and there was also the whole, you know, sort of the half-breed thing, or, you know, that kind of thing, which was very offensive, but it was
the name, yeah.
What people would call people.
You know, and it's also, I think that thing of, you know, you claiming your own name being called a zebra, being called Oreo, you know, all of the different Hyella.
Wow.
All of those ones. Okay, so what does
that
mean?
That's part of history, though, isn't it?
Yeah, Cafe au lait. I kind of like that one. I always say I like my coffee like my skin.
Oh, no. Well, so through the years, you've embraced the term mulatto.
Hmm.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. and it's also provocative for people, too. And in that, you can trace your history. You can trace not just your history, but the history of that name.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I just had the great good fortune to be in New Orleans, where I have not spent a lot of time before. And the mulatto culture there is such an amazing, strong, vibrant, like separate identity. And that's problematic in some ways. And also a reason for celebration. I mean, when we talk about diversity, there's diversity between each two people. You know, it's not just this group of people versus this group of people, yeah? And so to see all the different ways that we...
Well, we blend.
Blend, yes, yeah. That's a perfect word.
We blend, we mix. Now, what are some of the artistic disciplines that you use for this show, Boxmark Black?
For this show, my background is in experimental and devised theater making. So there was a lot of playing with forms. So we'd come up with, I'm portraying family members as well as iconic historical characters as well as TV show characters. So trying to figure out different ways, and it's just me in a trunk. So how many different ways can I reach this? And some of these universal sorts of situations became filtered through my body through contemporary dance and movement. And then there's also vocal work, singing. There is puppetry, as we mentioned
Soft
before.
Puppets, yes. Well, I'd love to hear a piece from it. Could you intro it for us?
I sure can. This is actually the very beginning of the play, The Box Marked Black. Tales of African American growing up mulatto with sock puppets. Stuart is my cousin on my father's side. Loud, proud, and black. Of my first cousins, he is the one closest to me in age, being only 5 years my senior. But in the late 70s, those 5 years made him wise in my eyes. With his bushy afro, thick lips, wide grin, and a gaze that mirrored his delight with the world. His skin was just a shade darker than mine, but somehow, was it the kink of his hair? The fact that he had two black parents raising him? Or that he sometimes wore a hairnet? But somehow, Stuart was black, and I wasn't. I remember asking him, "Stuart, what do you say when somebody asks you, what's up?"
"Oh, cuz, you say the sky.
Dammy?
You tell them the sky."
My father is the patriarch of our extended Portland-based family, the eldest and only blood-related, non-adopted child of my grandmother. My father was born on a rural farm in eastern Tennessee, the grandbaby of a freed slave and a Cherokee. His mother was one of 11 children. Now my grandmother? She was a teacher, a nurse, and a Christian missionary who married a Baptist minister, who brought the whole family out to Oregon to spread the word of the Lord. People say I favor my grandmother. We have the same smile, the same shaped eyes. My right foot sticks out like hers when I walk. We have the same hands, only mine are bigger. With my grandmother's hands, she baked bread for my father. She poured him a glass of water from the tap and a cup of Kool-Aid from the plastic pitcher. She laid the table and folded them in prayer. Jesus wept. Shortest passage in the Bible, dammy. She soothed my father's fevered brow and pointed him on the path that she could no longer walk.
Now my father, he marched with the Black Panthers. He sat at those lunch counters before the segregation lines came down, and he was in those first classes at the University of Oregon that finally allowed coloreds. And he married a white woman.
Beautifully done. You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Demi Roberts. That's my guest, Damaris Webb, performing from her solo show, The Box Marked Black, Tales from a African American Growing Up Mulatto. And it performs one night only on Friday, March 6th at 7 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church. And that's located at 1624 Northeast Hancock Street, basically 16th and Northeast Hancock. And reservations are requested, and you can email the secretary at westprespdx.org by March 3rd, so you can get a ticket there. But admission is a can of food or other non-perishable item welcome at the door, and it's donated to the Northeast Emergency Fund Program. Good cause, good show. And I have all of that info at stageandstudio.org as well as this interview. In the few remaining moments, I'm just curious, what is your best advice for artists who are performing solo shows or writing their own personal stories and performing them?
Give yourself deadlines. Just keep
just
showing
like anything
the work.
Else.
Yeah,
right.
Just keep showing the work. I think that there is an anxiety and a certain inertia that happens because we don't have an ensemble necessarily expecting things from us immediately. So I had the great good fortune in New York City. There's an organization called Dixon Place, which allows artists who are in that kind of in-between, not fully produced place, to present their work in front of an audience where they have technicians, etc., for one night at no cost. You have to apply for the thing and be selected, but that opportunity to create those types of situations for ourselves, I think, is invaluable.
So having a workshop connection somehow,
yes,
with something that will push you forward.
Yes, and those kind of performance deadlines.
One of the questions I get, though, regarding the content is how deep do you go when it's a personal story?
I think it is possible to find a form for yourself to go as deep as you need to. And whether that is abstracted through the lens of another character, or through movement, or through song, I think that for myself as a performer, I can touch those deeper places and put a little bit of safety in the sharing of it. It doesn't have to be all hanging out.
Or all therapy, right?
Exactly. Bottom line is we're storytelling.
Right. Good advice. Thank you so much. Damaris Webb's show, The Box Marked Black, is performing one night only, Friday, March 6th at 7 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church. And for more info, you can also visit damarisweb.com. That's D-A-M-A-R-I-S, web with two B's, .com, or stageandstudio.org. Damaris Webb, thank you so much for joining us today. I could talk to you for hours and hours. It's so great to have you here have you share your story with us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Up next, I talk with Matt Colbert, a high school teacher in Newburgh, Oregon. He's just published his debut novel, The Futility of Nicknames. It's a story about a man who has shared the same name with his best friend who gets killed in a car crash. And then he goes on a search to remake himself in his small town. He seems pulled into the town's sordid past and present while going on this downward spiral as he tries to find himself. I talked to Matt last week about his new book because the main character of The Futility of Nicknames is a teacher in a small town like Matt. I asked him how much of his life is reflected in the book and what inspired him to write it.
In college, my best friend, he had the same name as I did, and particularly because we were both studying Spanish as well as other things. In Spanish class, the professor, Professor Gonzalez, always called him Mateo, and I was always Matt. And it was fine, you know, she had to have some way to tell us apart. But because of that, it just kind of stayed with me. And so after college, and as I began to write the novel, I started thinking about how, you know, easily we identify, you know, with names and what they say about us. And I just took that and then started asking a lot of what-if questions. You know, what if there was an accountant who was really interested in books? And what if he had this friend, but there were, you know, jealousy and other concerns between them?
Well, I'm going to make a full disclosure here because I've known you and your wife for years, and I know you both live in a small town of Newburgh. How much of the experiences of working as, I mean, the main character is a school teacher, and he lives in a small town.
He is.
So how much did that influence your main character in your story?
Not very much at all. I used it on the book as kind of a tease for the people who do know me and are reading the book. And I've had, you know, some of our friends say, you know, when they're reading the book, they can just hear my voice. And I have to remind them that, no, this is fiction. But the setting I created, you know, the fake town, obviously, you know, Dodson is a real town. But Mayfield, I just made up and thought, well, I'll put somewhere near Portland because it is the area where I grew up and where I live currently. But no, most of it hasn't been an influence of where I live.
But I think a lot of people who know you are going to be wondering about that. Have you thought about that?
They might, but I don't think they're going to, you know, necessarily see this as a criticism, particularly because where I am in Newburgh, we're not, you know, near the river the way, you know, Mayfield is. And that's a major part of it as well, the tide and the river and all that.
So the main character has a friend with the exact same first name, and then his friend dies.
He does.
And so he goes on a search for his own identity. And part of that search leads him to some pretty tawdry discoveries in this small town.
Yes.
What did you base that on?
Well, a lot of what I was thinking about is sort of this notion of confirmation bias and how so often we want to be something else, you know, we want maybe, you know, the best part of other people's lives and don't necessarily think about the parts of their lives that are unenviable and perhaps even tragic. So for Martin, when he's searching for his identity and I suppose the truth about Cecile and the truth about, you know, his small town, I think he begins it wishing, you know, for this great change. And the more he uncovers, it's like he can't stop himself. And in some ways, he uses what he's finding in the town to justify, you know, as though there's a historical precedent. You know, he reads a lot about the history of town that, oh, this is what I'm meant to be and what I need to become. But that's not the reality. And he's not an admirable character. I don't think this is, you know, how you should, you know, live your life. Obviously, we have to face, you know, terrible things in our lives sometimes, but to just say, oh, I'm going to become this, or, you know, I'm going to use this to justify, you know, kind of how I've behaved, that's not what I'm advocating.
I looked on Amazon and there was a short review. It was actually one line. There were several reviews, but the one that stuck out for me is just one line. Somebody wrote, a study on a guy bent on destroying himself by finding the truth. What do you think of that?
I think that's a really kind of accurate description of what happens in the novel. And I think he senses it even in the early part of the novel, and certainly it's why he treats Marty and does what he does. You know, he treats Marty a certain way, he does what he does, because he suspects his wife's infidelity. He suspects that his friend has done more than he's let on. He suspects that even, you know, Marty's flaws have gotten so out of hand that they're kind of capturing his life as well. And though he may not want to face it, he needs to find out, you know, to satisfy himself.
The main character in your novel goes on a search for the town's history, too. And did you base any of that town history on any particular place?
No, I completely made that up. I was because I was thinking about how Marty wanted to find truth in his personal life. And I thought, I'll, you know, invent this history, this founding of the town, and just, you know, sort of give it a vague feeling of, well, you know, that could have happened, that might have happened, but I didn't base it on anything. I wanted him to use, you know, anything that's not concrete, that's not decided, he uses to springboard his own belief system. Again, what I was talking about, that sense of confirmation bias, that there's nothing there to say this is the way it is. And of course, there's disputes about the town founding and the characters like Bird and Hart.
When you say that you made all of that up, why do you think this search for the history of the town is so important? I mean, he really does go into depths into looking into that town history.
I think he likes to search at the town's history because in some ways it allows him to avoid or at least counterbalance his personal history. And so the more he discovers about the town, he can either think that, yes, this is the way it must be, or, well, you know, that's kind of like what's in my life. And he can draw those parallels and once more, you know, justify himself.
Is this the first book that you, I know this is the first book that you've published, but is this the first book that you've actually, you know, that you've written? Do you have other novels?
It is. It is. I have others sort of in different stages of development, but this is the first one I've written and published.
And how long did it take you?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's the question I always dread the most when people say, oh, how long did it take you to write this? Because the initial writing isn't necessarily something I remember at this point. I think it, you know, I just had the idea. And for everything I write that's longer than a short story or a poem, I always like to plan out, and I'll create a plan and really, you know, get a rough outline of the characters as well. And for each chapter, you know, have a sense of this is what they're going to do in this chapter, because I like that skeletal outline. And then as things happen organically, I can add more to the plan. So I'm sure I did that, but I wrote it some years ago, and then I let it sit for a number of years because I didn't think it was ready. And I, you know, well, as a teacher, time is not always the commodity I have a lot of. So I didn't work on it. I worked on other stuff. I wrote poetry. I wrote short stories. I planned out another novel, and then I came back to it. And I always tell my students that good writing is rewriting, you know, that it's okay to have that crummy first draft, and then you can find the things that work there and revise them as well. So I had a crummy first draft sitting, and then I decided that, no, I want to get serious about this. I want to revise it. I want to find those things that are working in it. And so the revision process after writing, you know, for about a year and then letting it sit, the revision process was probably another year or two. And then I began to try to send it out and find a publisher or find an agent. And in this case, I was fortunate. I found a small publisher that looked at it and wanted to work with it.
Well, congratulations on that. I just wonder at this, for your first book, though, why was it important for you to have someone who's an anti-hero? I mean, the main character is really not that likable.
No, he's not.
And so why did you go that route?
I don't know. I mean, it was just something I wrote, you know, this. I mean, I admire a lot of what, you know, humanity does, but I also, you know, I don't want to write a really simple, you know, just everything's, you know, going to work out and everything's great and sunshine and roses. So when I wrote him, I just started discovering that, yeah, there could be a lot of dark things in him as well. And because I was thinking as well about my friend from college who has the same name, I wanted to make it separate from that. I didn't want him to feel like, oh, wait, here's a novel, two guys, you know, they went to college together. That's, you know, that's too familiar. So I went in the opposite direction. I mean, he and I are still friends today. I'm a godfather to one of his children. We were best men at each other's wedding. So, you know, we keep in touch. We see each other, you know, as often as we can. And I didn't want it to be just, oh, here's, you know, my personal story. So I thought I'll create this fictional story. It won't be about him. It won't be about me. There are certainly parts of me in all of the characters in the book, but hopefully not as many, you know, negative things or those terrible flaws.
So it, in some ways, it was a way to divert from the actual comparison that this is autobiographical in some ways.
Yeah, I hope people don't read it as an autobiography. I tell people, we had a party the other day, and a friend of ours came up from Corvallis, and he wanted to buy a copy of the book, which I have some around because I'm going to be doing a book signing in a couple weeks. And so that's exactly what I inscribed to him. I said, remember, this is fiction. You know, I don't want it to damage our friendship. But I also understand that by writing it in first person, people might hear that voice, might associate it with me. And the next book that I'm working on is in third person. So there may be a little more distance for readers to engage with.
Well, I think that's a good warning because I didn't have that warning. So I was thinking, oh, I don't like him. I don't know what happened to Matt. So so I'm glad to hear that this is total fiction, except
total
for
fiction.
Some resemblances as inspiration for truth.
Yeah.
Congratulations again. Matt Colbert, thank you for joining me on Stage and Studio.
Thank you.
That was Bette Colbert with his debut novel, The Futility of Nicknames. It's published by Champlain Avenue Books, and you can find out more about it. Actually, you can get it at Amazon.com. And there's an author book signing Friday, March 6th at 6 to 8 p.m. at Chapters Bookstore at 701 East 1st Street in Newburgh. And for more info, visit chaptersbooksandcoffee.com. And I have all of that info at stageandstudio.org. And Damaris just told me, Damaris Webb, who's doing the Boxmark Black, is doing another show April 15th at Oregon Episcopal School in PDX. And you can visit her site for more info at damariswebb.com or stageandstudio.org. That's it for today's show. Thank you to Janet Anderson, our engineer. And you can hear the show again at stageandstudio.org. Till next time, I'm Dimae Roberts. More music by Parfait Basalay.
It's time I see.
KBOO is a proud sponsor with Runaway Productions of Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4, February 27, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, 1507 Southeast 39th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. Bad Habitat, Tope, Speaker Minds, Mike Crenshaw, Kinetic MCs, Glenn Waco, Pale Soul, Flowmatic, Diction, Destro, Gums, Soul Miner, and many more. February 27, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4 starts at 9 p.m. and is 21 and up.
Art Focus is next with host Joseph Gallivan. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts. Freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from February 28th through Christmas Eve. Local artists.